All right, so hear me out now, would you? Is it possible that the era of big government being over is over? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 31st of March. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. And look, I know that was a big setup, the idea that the era of big government being over is over. The original quote, of course, coming from Bill Clinton's 1996 State of the Union. But given the news of the day, it is not outlandish to imagine that maybe it is over. President Biden rolled out his second multi-trillion dollar economic plan today, the American Jobs Plan. Infrastructure, as you've seen already, is the headline. About $2 trillion worth of investment into, yes, sure, roads and bridges and the power grid and building out green energy infrastructure. But here's the turn into the whole over thing. The White House is taking an expansive view, shall we say, of just what's included when we say infrastructure. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
One of the things under Biden's broader umbrella of infrastructure, more funding and resources for home health care workers. Bill Dombey is president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice.
As a matter of policy coming out of the White House, this is not a surprise, just simply the vehicle in which it's contained at the moment.
Putting healthcare into an infrastructure package is unusual, he says, but he hopes it works.
To address the very low level of compensation that many home care aides receive.
Although I love my work and what I do in home care, it really doesn't pay enough.
Terrell Cannon has worked for decades in home health care, where the median salary is just above the poverty line. Now, she's director of training at Home Care Associates of Philadelphia. She says she totally understands why home health care shows up in the Biden plan.
Just like the roads and the streets and the energy and things of that nature that's there, we should have been, because we are the essential workers to keep the quality of life going.
But having such a broad concept of infrastructure could make it harder to actually pass a bill, says Diana Furchgott-Roth, who teaches at George Washington University and worked at the Department of Transportation during the Trump administration.
There are going to be people who are going to want to break it up into different kinds of bills.
Because it's hard to be against an infrastructure bill, she says, but it could be easier for some lawmakers to oppose, say, a climate change bill or one to pay home health care workers higher salaries. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
So that's the setup, right? The broad conceptual piece of the story. But you spend $2 trillion, there is a certain amount of show me the money that is expected. And this bill, remember, is about improving infrastructure, broadly defined, to improve the economy. Part of the American Jobs Plan is $17 billion for inland waterways and ferries and coastal ports. And we have been telling you about how those ports have been struggling to handle all the imported stuff we have been buying for the past year. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, American ports have been in need of upgrades since well before this virus hit.
American ports could really use the help, says Dale Rogers, a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. He says when you look at the design of some foreign ports, like Shanghai or Rotterdam,
it's really brilliantly designed and engineered. And what we mostly have in the U.S. is infrastructure left over from an earlier time.
U.S. ports have been improving some to handle more imports and bigger ships. Mario Cordero is the executive director of the Port of Long Beach, which is part of the country's busiest port complex. He says the port is now prioritizing rail construction, which will help move cargo without burning as many fossil fuels.
But also in a more expedient manner to get the containers from the terminal and out of the harbor district.
Cordero says more investment in port infrastructure won't just let the port handle more capacity. It'll also help create jobs at the port itself and throughout the supply chain.
Whether it's jobs in the trucking community, jobs in warehousing, and of course jobs even when we talk about rail.
That could help pull in manufacturing and construction workers who've been out of work. But Dartmouth economics professor Emily Blanchard says there aren't as many unemployed workers in manufacturing or construction as in the service sector, which was disproportionately hit by COVID-19.
It's probably not the case that if you were waiting tables a year and a half ago, you're going to be jumping right in line to get involved in the reconstruction of the Baltimore port.
For supply chain jobs to boost the overall economy, Blanchard says the U.S. will have to invest in skills training. That, she says, will help unemployed people get better jobs and move up the income ladder. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Let's do a little context here, shall we? Before we go any farther, on the premise of the top half of the program today, that what we are seeing with Biden and the spending and the government getting more into this economy is maybe actually the end of Reaganomics. The idea that smaller government is better, that tax cuts are the way to go, trickle down and supply side and all of that. Molly Wood and I put basically that question to Mark Blythe yesterday on our podcast, Make Me Smart. Mark is a professor of political economy at Brown.
I really think a lot of this comes down to this, like, let's run this giant $2 trillion experiment on if we can generate inflation or not. And if we get real wage growth without any significant inflation, I think that Bidenomics will actually become a thing just as Reaganomics did.
I mean, we'll see, right? You can hear that whole conversation. It was a good one. IMHO, wherever you get your podcasts. On Wall Street today, tech was up. Most of the rest was mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is music news today. It comes to us from Cupertino, California, home of the media and hardware company that used to just make computers. Apple is leading a $50 million investment round in a company called United Masters. It's a company that helps artists distribute their music while letting them keep the rights to their masters, their original recordings. You might have heard Taylor Swift has been real active in doing that. Now, whether this deal will change that terrain, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on the music rights desk today.
Justin Trawick has this fantasy. He calls it the Grey's Anatomy moment.
The nurse is in tears because the doctor that she's been in love with doesn't love her back. And suddenly you hear my song playing for 30 seconds as she's walking out of the hospital.
This could be all just a dream.
That's Back of the Line by Justin Trawick and The Common Good. Trawick thinks the United Masters and Apple deal is appealing because he'd own his music and the company might have enough muscle to broker deals with networks and brands. But Marcus Thomas, who chairs the music management program at the University of Hartford, doesn't think United Masters can compete with record labels that pour millions into talent.
You have these megastars because of that investment. Without that, you have more of a middle class.
He's not saying that's bad. Not everyone wants to be Beyonce, though I personally don't know anyone who doesn't. But he does think this idea of independence and power that Apple and United Masters are pitching is a bit of a PR stunt.
This isn't suddenly every indie artist is going to have a Nike deal and they're all going to be like Kanye. There aren't that many deals to go around.
Clyde Kelly is an independent hip-hop singer-songwriter and a tech and media consultant.
One of the biggest things that I look at is, do they have a team that actually does things that a label would be doing typically?
Legal work, radio promotions, press tours. Kelly says unless he sees United Masters take up some of this work, he'll continue going it alone. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
A lot of businesses have had to do things differently this past year, just trying to get through this pandemic. Small businesses especially, which often have less of a cushion against the unexpected, and really small businesses in particular with maybe just a handful of employees. We've been talking to some of those micro businesses the past couple of weeks, checking in on them as they try to get customers back in the door. But what if your business is helping other businesses get customers to their doors? Carolyn Walker runs a marketing agency in New Haven, Connecticut. It's called Response. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Happy to be here.
So how is, big picture-ish, how's the advertising business going these days?
You know, it hasn't been an easy year for anyone. Yeah. But, you know, some have fared better than others. You know, some of our clients took a really hard hit at the beginning and are starting to climb out. And other clients actually surged. We saw a surge.
Give me a for instance on the ones who had a tough time and had to figure out their way through this with obviously your help.
Yeah. So one of our clients is Uncle Julio's Restaurant Group, and they're polished casual dining restaurants across the country.
Yeah.
And so as you can imagine, when the pandemic hit, they went from millions of dollars in sales every week to basically nothing. And so that hit them hard and hit us hard.
Well, so, but look, I mean, with all respect to your expertise over however many decades in this business, but there is not an advertising company in the world or a marketing company in the world, rather, that can help a restaurant when nobody wants to go out to eat, right?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. But basically what we did is we made a big switch in the strategy from, you know, using mass media tactics like television and radio and moved to lean into their owned media channels like their website and their social media and their email list, and basically, you know, let people know that they were still operating and available for, you know, takeout and delivery and things like that.
So how did Uncle Julio's do coming through this past year?
So it's been really interesting. One of the success stories is, you know, they had the brilliant idea of starting a virtual brand they called Savage Burrito. And so we helped them develop, name, launch Savage Burrito, basically serviced out of their Uncle Julio's kitchens across the country.
Hmm. All right. So as your clients are changing, I imagine you were having to shift some gears as well. Tell me about running your own marketing business in a pandemic.
Yeah, it hasn't been easy, like I said. When it first happened, you know, budgets were cut pretty dramatically. Our billings dropped by about 50%.
Wow.
We applied for the EIDL loan and got it in April. We applied for PPP, which also wasn't easy, but we got that in May. And we did end up laying off 4 people, but we were able to bring 2 of those 4 back. And we basically went to a totally remote situation. So we were already working one day from home, Fridays from home anyway, and we just went 100% virtual.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot lately about the whole getting back to the office thing and how that's looking increasingly like it's not going to be the way it was. What are you going to do when and if all y'all can go back to the office? Are you going to?
Yeah. So no, we're not going to. So it's really interesting. You're asking me this because just this week we moved the last of our stuff out of the office not planning to go back into a physical space.
Wow. So that's going to save you a ton of money. I mean, just to get down to brass tacks here, right? You don't have to pay rent.
Yeah.
You know.
That's right. We're going to save about $60,000 a year.
And if you need to get together when we all can, you can just do like a WeWork or some kind of co-working space, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we use Regis quite a bit. Yeah. So we have their space. And we're also members of the 4A's. And it's an advertising association in Manhattan. And they have space and actually lots of space right now.
Yeah.
And even just a coffee shop. I mean, honestly,
for
we're
sure.
so small, we can just meet in a coffee shop.
Totally. Any worries about continuing to run your own business in this post-pandemic era? You feeling good about it?
I feel really good about it. I feel like if I made it through this, we can make it through anything.
Amen. Carolyn Walker, she's the CEO, managing partner as well of Response Agency in New Haven, Connecticut. Carolyn, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
It is crunching, you know, a few billion rows of data here.
Big and fast data. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 85 points today, about 0.2% on the blue chips, ended things at 32,981. The NASDAQ gained 201 points, 1.5%, 13,246 for technology. The S&P 500 up 14 points, about 0.3%. 39.72. Walgreens improved 3.6% today. The pharmacy chain posted better than expected earnings and raised its full-year profit forecast to boot. Other pharmacy-related stocks, Rite Aid, 3.4% to the good. CVS, down 1.1%. BlackBerry, which is somehow still around, down 10.5% after its fourth quarter revenue missed analyst expectations. Bond prices, well, they fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.74%. Do not think about inflation when you see that number. Think about a growing economy. That's what rising bond yields kind of mean sometimes, you know? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, the thing about the economics of this pandemic, the early parts of it anyway, was how fast it happened. We went from a pretty good economy, really, to recession in basically the blink of an eye. It all happened so quickly that the economy was moving faster than the data. And that explains why, a couple of weeks ago, I sat down for an interview in the studios here at Marketplace World Headquarters. So let's just, sorry, I'm deselecting my self-view here. Zoom, of course.
So let me share my screen here.
So that Ray Sanza, he's from a company called Homebase, could show me a little something.
Give it a second.
Oh, it's all good. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, this is it is crunching, you know, a few billion rows of data here in the background.
just a couple. Homebase does employee scheduling and time tracking software. Most of their customers are small businesses like restaurants and retail stores and coffee shops.
So I'm going to show you here just the time cards from a particular individual.
It's all anonymized, of course.
This is one individual in Sherman, Texas, that is working. You'll see every single day, the day that the time that they started working and the time that they stopped working.
13:29, so that's what we have. So 1:29 in the afternoon to 6:11 in the evening. Okay, got it.
Exactly. Interestingly, you know, you see, notice the 7-day gap between the 13th and the 20th.
Look at that.
Yep. So there's another.
Oh, that was in Sherman, Texas. That was the ice storm in Texas, of course. Right. So this person got no hours for 7 days.
Yep. Exactly. And they normally do get some hours every day.
The economic impact of that winter storm last month on small businesses in Texas is right there in Homebase's time cards.
Right there in February, it drops, and it drops, you know, 80%.
80%.
That basically continues for the week. But then the really crazy thing is next Monday, what's happening? It's back where it was. So you know what our indicators say? Our indicators say that never happened.
Indicators like the monthly unemployment rate, which is based on surveys taken during one specific week of the month. So if that storm had happened to fall on a different week than the one they asked about?
Our indicators say that never happened. But you ask a worker there, and a worker lost a week's worth of wages. And a small business lost a week worth of revenue.
It's a hole, basically, in the indicators. Economists might have known it was there intellectually, but people in the actual economy trying to get by, they felt it. This virus hit this economy so hard and so fast that it blew that gap wide open, and it forced economic policymakers to find a new set of tools to measure it. Tools like that Homebase data. How do you know what you know? What are you looking at to get a sense of what's going out there in the economy? I mean, the Dallas Fed has a bunch of tools. I'm sure you've got your go-tos. That's me with Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan back in December.
So I'm looking at all the normal financial and economic data, but the concern about that in this crisis is that by the time you get the data, it's stale. So we've more than ever have gone to high-frequency data.
When the economy is changing like it normally does, which is slowly, the normal data, the jobs report and retail sales, construction spending maybe, that's all fine. But last spring was not normal.
What we think of as sort of non-standard high-frequency data, that's become a very important thing.
That, of course, is Jay Powell. It was last year. And that high-frequency data he's talking about is anything released, you know, frequently. The weekly unemployment claims we talk about on Thursdays. The daily TSA throughput numbers as well. But other kinds of high-frequency data from private companies have become go-to pandemic indicators as well. Restaurant reservations on OpenTable, hotel occupancy rates, credit card transactions. One thing that is different about that kind of data, though, is that it's not coming from surveys. It's data that you create every time you go out to dinner or buy something with a credit card or clock into work. And there is another example coming straight from the phone in your pocket.
You, as the person holding that phone, at some point in this process, you said, yep, it's okay to track my location.
That's Jonathan Wolf at a location data company called SafeGraph.
And so I pulled up an example here. We happen to be looking at the Sherman Town Center. It's a mall in Sherman, Texas, which is outside of Houston.
Remember those time cards from that one business in Sherman, Texas I was looking at with Ray Sanza from Homebase? SafeGraph can tell us how many customers might be walking into that business.
So in this picture that we're looking at is actually the building footprint for the mall itself.
That's a big mall.
And you see, it's a big mall. And we've actually gone through the effort of chopping up all of these malls and shopping centers to say, okay, well, I know that this thing is a TJ Maxx. I know the thing right next to it is Jonathan's Craft Store. And I know the thing right next to that is a Starbucks. And so when we talk about visits to these different places, we know that they're at the TJ Maxx because we can see they're in this particular shape, not in the shape next door.
Wow. Companies like SafeGraph and Homebase collect information in real time. Anonymized, of course, but literally as people are moving around shopping malls or clocking into work. The Texas winter storm is just one example. But a year ago, Ray Sanza from Homebase, he saw the virus coming for this economy.
We saw a 10% reduction in the Seattle area. And we said, holy, insert bad word here, this is really, really bad. We have to let somebody know.
And they did.
So the first thing we did is we said, let's go to the press. So we reached out and said, we have this data. Things are really bad. And a lot of them were just like, cool, who are you? And so they did not pay a lot of attention. But our goal here was just like, policymakers, you have to see this. These folks need money and other economic indicators will not show this for another month.
I mean, normally business cycles turn down very gradually, kind of like a big barge. You have to kind of gradually turns, and this turned like a speedboat.
That's Keith Phillips.
I'm a regional economist at the Dallas Fed. I've been at the Dallas Fed for about 37 years.
He's one of the people way down in the weeds of economic data, trying to figure out how to use all that data. And he says the jobs report last May, after just terrible numbers in April 2020, was a really big turning point for the high-frequency crowd.
Most economists expected another decline in May, and what happened was the economy actually bounced back quite sharply in May and kind of caught people off guard. And we realized there are these other more timely data out there that would have given us a warning about that change in the economy.
Do you imagine maintaining this information in your data sets once things are normal, whatever that turns out to be, and whenever it gets here?
Yes, because hopefully there won't be another pandemic for a very long time. This is Texas, and there'll be storms. There'll be hurricanes and other things that we can use this data to kind of track the depth of the hit and how long it lasts.
High-frequency data gives Keith Phillips and his bosses at the Dallas Fed and Jay Powell in Washington a better picture of this economy.
It's not like policy changes based, you know, on daily data, but the sooner we know that there's been a dramatic change or improvement is occurring, the better off we are.
This is about more than hurricanes or winter storms or even global pandemics. It's about that gap that we always talk about between the fundamentals and people's lived experience. It's probably always going to be there, that gap. But the more information we have and the faster we get that information, a lot of it from you, the better we can manage this economy. This final note on the way out today, aviation is the topic at hand. First of all, TSA throughput, one of my favorites, as all y'all know. Yesterday, 1.1 million people got screened to get on a plane. A lot, but still about half of what it was today in the before times. Just for some context, it was, though, the 20th day in a row over a million. Told you that so I could tell you this. Delta Airlines said today it's going to lift its block on selling middle seats come May the 1st. It is the last of the big American carriers to get rid of that blocking middle seats policy. So, with the middles back in play, remember, the window seat person gets to decide whether the shade is up or down. The middle person gets both, yes, both armrests, and the aisle person gets to get up wherever they like. Those are the rules. I did not make them up. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context on a Wednesday. Back to the president's infrastructure plan, all $2 and maybe more trillion of it. This comes from the most recent report card on American infrastructure from the American Society of Civil Engineers. In 2019, we spent 2.5% of our GDP, our entire economy, on infrastructure. That is a shortfall, the group says, of what we should be spending of almost $3.7 trillion over the next decade. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostedt, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. Must pause here to note that they're the ones coming into the studio every single day, so the rest of us don't have to, unless fill in the blank about your home internet. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.